WKAR's current state for news, the arts, issues, music, and more. We are glad you're here. I'm Mark Bayshore. I loved reading this story yesterday, and maybe you got wind of this a little while ago. I got wind of it somehow, and I don't remember how or where, but for the first time in nearly 50 years, people are allowed to fish in the Red Cedar River on Michigan State University's campus. The DNR announced Tuesday that hook and line fishing will be permitted on the north bank of the river between the western edge of Brody Complex and the Sparty Bridge. A 1960s ordinance banned fishing on MSU's campus, and people interested in fishing in this part of the Red Cedar River must still have a fishing license. But what kind, Rick Pluta, what kind of fish do you think are in the Red Cedar?
I'm wondering, what do they know that we don't?
I'm thinking salmon, bass, maybe the occasional pike.
Yeah, maybe. They'll do something to make them green and white for homecoming.
It's going to
maybe they don't have to.
I'm gonna actually enjoy seeing people fishing from the banks of the Red Cedar. I think that's kind of cool. Well, WKAR listeners hear Rick Pluta's work daily on our local newscasts on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, and on National Public Radio. Rick is Capital Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, and he's seen pretty regularly on Off the Record with Tim Skubick on WKAR-TV as well, and he knows the state capitol as well as anybody. Rick, thanks for stopping by.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
What do you think Governor Snyder would like to accomplish in this address tonight? I mean, if he's got a goal, what is his goal?
Really, the same goal that any governor has delivering this address, or for that matter, the president, when the president delivers the State of the Union address. One is a defense of job performance over the past year, if you have a past year on the job to defend, but a defensive job performance in the past year, and then, setting the path forward. This is your opening argument in what you hope will be an agenda for the coming year. Much of it, but not all of it, directed at the legislature. You know that traditionally these were the reports of the executive, the CEO of the state, to the legislative branch. But over the years they've developed into much, much more than that. That this is a public case for an agenda as well.
Is he going to use it though to try to persuade? How much of the address is about persuading people to alter their thinking?
Almost all of it, and probably not to any great result. I mean, it's just the fact of the matter that typically speaking, one speech doesn't do that. And we know that Governor Snyder is going to have a big sell. Well, look, if we just tick through the things that we're expecting, we expect him to talk about workforce development. It's a particular passion of his. He says that we have lots of available workers, we have lots of jobs, and for some reason they are not being connected. So that's one of them. He said he's going to talk about the Great Lakes, that Michigan is the only state that is entirely within the watershed of the world's largest freshwater supply. And he sees not just quality of life, but economic opportunity in that. So that will set some people on edge, but it's also something big that he wants to talk about this year. And the one that people have been talking about, at least over at the Capitol going into this, is transportation funding.
Right.
Last year, the governor, he said that we need to collect a billion for more a year just to fix the roads we have. This isn't about expanding or even really improving. Just to keep
maintenance.
Just to keep what we've got good enough to use. And he threw out some ideas but didn't really commit to anything. He says this year he's going to be a lot more specific in terms of what he wants, throw out some specific plans. We'll probably be seeing something in the form of a gas tax, maybe a sales tax, which would require voter approval, local registration fees or registration fees, and local option registration fees, so that if a region decides to commit to big transportation improvements, they can go it alone without waiting on the state.
A patchwork kind of approach, then, is what you're saying.
Somewhat.
To a point.
I mean, that would be one of the complaints about it, that, you know, once you get past a particular county line, all of a sudden your transit system, whatever it is, changes in some way, shape, or form.
Right. I see Jace Bolger, the Republican Speaker of the House, wants
and the person who really runs the Capitol these days.
Okay, yeah, he is quoted an awful lot, wants the legislature to look at more efficient spend. This is no big surprise. Wants the legislature to look at more efficient spending of current funds before any new taxes are considered. But Mr. Bolger admitted he may be open to the idea of a use tax.
This was almost a page from the John Engler playbook. You might remember him. He was the governor of Michigan back in the 1990s.
Yes.
And what Jace Bolger laid out was really almost exactly what John Engler did, is that he recognized more than a year out that Michigan needed to come up with more money for roads and bridges, for transportation, and the place where you got it was from the gas tax. But he knew he couldn't just come out front and call for one. First of all, people wouldn't accept it. Certainly his conservative base, he was a conservative Republican governor, at least conservative for the time, his conservative base would not accept that. And so he had to go, and he spent a year demanding that MDOT become the Michigan Department of Transportation, become more efficient. He squeezed efficiencies out of them. He made it extremely, extremely public that he was doing it. I mean, MDOT was kind of an uncomfortable place to be during the Engler years, for that reason.
Okay.
And at the end of it, he said, okay, I've made the case. Now it's time for a gas tax increase. And he got one. Now, the problem in 2013 is we're moving into an era where it's not just fossil fuel engines, that we've got a lot more electric cars, hybrids, they're more fuel efficient, people are driving fewer miles.
And revenue has shrunk.
Which means that the gas tax is a less reliable, less stable source of revenue for
that.
So how do you come up with a plan going forward, which is why people are talking about the sales tax, devoting a portion of the sales tax to roads, maybe increasing it by a penny or two. That would require voter approval. These registration fees, not allowing those registration fees to go down as the value of a car depreciates, so that captures more revenues. Things that aren't entirely dependent on the number of gallons that you buy.
But a use tax, if I understand it correct, correct me if I'm wrong, but a use tax would apply just as much to a Nissan Leaf as it would to a Cadillac CTS-V coupe, because it's miles traveled on the road, regardless of what kind of vehicle.
Well, that's a little bit different. That the governor is intrigued by the idea of a miles traveled tax. He says the problem is there's really no way to effectively measure that and collect it right now. So if that's something that's going to happen, that's going to be, pardon the expression, further down the road.
Okay.
But
we're going to kick that can down the road, that gas can down the road. Okay.
But registration fees, especially ones that say maybe take into account the weight of a vehicle, literally how much pressure it puts on the road.
That's relevant.
Might be a way to create not a perfectly stable source of funding that reflects use and all of that, but something that's more than what it is right now.
Do you anticipate hearing about the Education Achievement Authority?
If he mentions it, it will be very, very much in passing.
Okay. What divides the parties on that? On that, right? And again, this is the state already
this
has.
This is not an issue. We sort of, the world sort of looks at the capitals in Lansing and D.C. as a realm divided between the R's and the D's, the Republicans and the Democrats. But in our modern society, we have so many more things dividing us than just political parties.
Doesn't seem like it.
It's clearly political parties are huge. But one of the things that for as long as I can remember, and I've been covering the Capitol for 25 years, that divides lawmakers, regardless of party affiliation, is what kind of schools you have. And that is the division there. And it's not strictly Republicans versus Democrats. Republicans from places where people are largely satisfied with their schools are not looking to upset the apple cart when it comes to education. That's the division.
NPRN's Rick Pluta. We'll have you back soon, Rick, and we'll be listening tonight at 7 o'clock here on WKAR Radio for the address itself and for a little bit of analysis afterwards and the Democratic response.
Speech, correct? Democratic response, analysis, one joke.
Okay. One joke, make it good. NPRN's Rick Pluta. Thanks, Rick. For not quite 4 months or so, the Ingham County Eviction Program, the Ingham County Eviction Diversion Program, has sought to keep renters from being evicted from their apartments or homes. The program aims to help good tenants who've fallen on hard times due to joblessness, high utility bills, or medical bills, not deadbeat tenants who, for whatever reason, simply don't pay their rent. The program's collaborative effort between the 55th District Court in Mason, various social service agencies, and MSU was launched in September. And here to explain it is Michael Syracuse. Michael's an attorney and legal fellow at MSU's Housing Law Clinic. And Sue Lynn Holbrook, director of Ingham County's Department of Human Services. Welcome to WKAR's Current State.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to come in. Some percentage of the time, eviction leads to homelessness, and that can involve all kinds of trauma and costs, social and otherwise. Are a lot of evictions unnecessary or avoidable?
I think I might let Sue Lynn comment on that a little bit. I believe so.
Okay.
Given the amount of agencies in the area that can offer funding, I think we can avoid many evictions. But she's the expert on.
Yeah, you run the DHS in the county. What's your take, Sue Lynn?
Well, I think we have two types of homelessness. One, you have an acute, which is what we deal with, where you have the one-time person that struggles, and as a result, they wind up being homeless. They're usually families. And then you also have the chronic, which is one of our partners deal with, which is Voice of, Volunteers of America.
Is that more of a mental illness dynamic?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. And so they need more of the services, supportive services to find housing.
Okay. And the program does not, we want to clarify, this program does not involve foreclosures. This is strictly people renting an apartment or a floor in a house or something like that.
That's correct.
Well, I would like to comment on that
sure,
a little bit.
Sure, sure.
I mean, that is what we discussed previously, but we do run across foreclosure issues, but the program is designed to help renters.
Okay. Sometimes a landlord is foreclosed upon. Is that the deal?
Right.
Yeah.
So sometimes, the person who's renting the home has the landlord foreclosed on them.
Of course. We're talking two main parts to your new program to eviction prevention. The first is apparently dealing with the eviction notice by simply getting the rent paid up. That's the first step. Tell us about that.
Okay. So In my mind, there's four parts to an eviction. So there's the notice, which is required before a summons and a complaint can be issued to the tenant. And then after the summons is the document that lets the tenant know when they're supposed to go to court. After that, the people go to court. Let's say many of them don't go to court and they get default judgments against them.
Okay.
So after the complaint is the judgment, and then after the judgment is the writ of eviction. And that's when the sheriff comes to the door and actually throws somebody out on the street.
Okay. But you are lined up with social service agencies who are actually coming up with cash.
Yes.
In order to cover maybe a month's rent, a couple of months' rent, just to buy the renter enough time to kind of repair the situation. Is that how it works?
That's correct. And
okay.
What we're hoping with this program is that people will come to us when they receive the summons so that we will have time to help them with getting what we call state of emergency relief. Or for capital area community services, they also can help with some funding for rent.
What factors determine whether an agency like capital area
Communities, or CACS. Yep. They're one of your partners, right?
Yep. That's correct.
What factors determine whether or not they say, yeah, we'll help, or no, we won't? I mean, do they ever decline to help because the situation is just so complicated or anything like that?
Well, it starts with the Department of Human Services, and if they have too much asset or if they've already reached their cap.
I'm sorry, the state or the county?
The state.
The state DHS.
So the state provides what we call a state of emergency relief, and the cap is, there's a certain cap. We pay the first month's rent and security deposit. But if we can't help them, Capital Area Community Services, they need a denial letter from DHS. So you could say DHS in some ways is the starting point to determine if they need money. Now, we also had Salvation Army that provided FEMA money as well for some people until the FEMA money ran out. So that was another resource.
How many people have you helped so far? I know the program just goes back to September, but how many people have you gotten involved with here?
Well,
I do have some numbers on that. We've looked like we've compiled our data between the 19th of September and the 26th of December. So we've actually been going back for a couple of weeks since this data was compiled, but 166 total scheduled evictions or docket items between those dates, and that's about a three-month period, of which we believe that we've achieved settlements on almost half of those, 81 out of that 166.
Wow. Those are much higher numbers than I would have expected.
Right.
That's encouraging. And I understand financial education is another part of your program. Once you kind of restore stability to the situation, then you try to do some remediation and say, hey, here's how you may have gone wrong. Tell us about that.
Well, currently, Capital Area Community Service, they require that you have financial education. And so DHS and also VOA does not. And so that's what got us started. We have contacted banks and local credit unions and agencies that provide financial literacy to come together and provide some free education on budgeting and helping so that people do not, it does not reoccur again. And it's exciting because this group is excited about it. We're looking at doing a standard two-hour class for people anywhere in the county, so you get the same information. And then if you want to go further, there'll be other classes that they'll be able to participate in for this offering.
What's the dynamic with the people involved in the eviction diversion program and the landlord's attorneys? That must get tense on occasion. You've got negotiating
yes.
to
yes.
do, obviously.
Negotiating sometimes requires there to be raised voices and the occasional argument.
Sure.
And so this is a great opportunity. See, this program is not just great for the tenants. And one of the things that makes it unique is we have all of these financial aid organizations on site, and they can help those tenants when they go to the courtroom. So they're not even aware that when they're going to go to the courtroom that day, they're going to get all of this free help, free legal representation, free negotiation for themselves,
yeah.
free access to these financial aid organizations, which would otherwise be spread out all over the city and they'd have to go find. But one of the other benefits is the benefits to the law students that I take with me to the program.
Tell us about that, because your students are involved in this.
So we have second and third year law students involved in the program. We bring about four or five of them each week during the semester when there's no holidays, and then we take them there, and they get to negotiate with landlords' attorneys, and they get to do client representation and explain the situation to their clients. They even get to appear on the record in front of the judges, which is something they really, really want to do. Many second year law students have never been able to do that before, or never met a judge before, are scared out of their minds about meeting a judge. So they get in front of the judge multiple times every Wednesday and dozens of times over the course of a semester.
Pretty valuable experience.
It's very valuable experience. And it doesn't work without all of the different parties involved participating and encouraging the participation, including the financial aid organizations of DHS and CACS and the judges. Very important. Judge Boyd and Allen have been incredibly gracious, letting us use not only their space, but letting us pick their brains
Judge Boyd's been a real catalyst, if I understand.
Yes, he has. Okay. But the blowback from plaintiff's attorneys has been significant at times. So some of them are coming around because ultimately, if the program works the way it's supposed to work, they will actually get in and out of the courtroom faster than they would otherwise normally do so.
Sure, sure.
And then they love that, right? And their clients still get paid. It's just a fast track to get the financial aid to the people who need it, and then on to the landlords who are owed that money.
Part of what's in play here, too, is that Ingham County shelters, at least as I understand it, are so crowded, if not full, on occasion, correct? So the shelters, yes. So when people are evicted, they in some cases, they got nowhere to go.
That's correct. And the other thing about Ingham County is that we're the second highest county, so first Wayne, then Ingham, in terms of paying out shelter care. And there's something wrong with that.
What's behind that?
Well, because people are not moving out, and so we have to continually pay shelter. And so we're number two, and that's what pushed us to start looking at the eviction diversion so that we wouldn't add families onto that problem.
It's important to know that we're number two in spending, but we're not number two in population. So we're spending an inordinate amount of money, more than other cities, other urban locations within the state, than we should. You know, okay. And we have to get that number down somehow.
You ever get into it with a landlord who finds that what he or she considers an undesirable tenant is back in their property because of your help?
No, but I've gotten into it with landlords and attorneys for landlords for other things. sometimes, the landlord just wants the tenant out. And in situations like that, we will sort of negotiate a time for those persons to leave. That's good for them. That gives them enough time to leave. But there are other things that we argue with the landlords and the landlord's attorneys, including late fees, which, according to statute, are supposed to be reasonable, other damage assessments, that sort of thing. So raised voices do sometimes occur, but we try to keep that to a minimum.
What's the future? Now, it's not this program, as I understand, is not costing the taxpayer any more money than was being spent before the program was in existence. What's the future of the eviction diversion program, do you think?
Well, it's definitely the credit unions and the banks coming on. That will be a different phase. And then also, we do have two housing hours that we want people to know about. One is at the Advent House on Tuesdays from 3 to 4. And so if you have any questions about housing, we would like for you to come there. And then we also have a housing hour from 3:30 to 4:30 in Mason on Mondays every week.
Long term, we would like the program to expand to the other two district courts in Ingham County,
I imagine.
54A and B.
Yeah.
And then if it's successful, it'll spread statewide.
But again, we just want to be preventative, and that's the whole goal.
The Ingham County County Eviction Diversion Program. Michael Syracuse is an attorney and legal fellow at MSU's Housing Law Clinic. Sue Lynn Holbrook is Ingham County DHS Director. Many thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for
your
time.
On the second half of Current State here on WKAR, we welcome Joan Nelson, director of the Allen Neighborhood Center. You may well know Joan. We're going to talk about a new segment on Current State called Neighbors in Action and part two of Peter Wharf's segment on Michigan's role in the Civil War. That's on the way on Current State. State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Good morning. Many thanks for joining us. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org. And we are starting to get a lot of emails from people with all kinds of interesting ideas as far as segments go. So we appreciate that. Criticism, feedback, positive, negative, more of this, less of that, whatever. currentstate@wkar.org. Today on the show, we roll out our first recurring segment that is really going to rely on you, our Current State listeners. It's called Neighbors in Action. Starting today and every Wednesday, we'll feature a person or organization that's working to make our community a better place. Now, this is a listener-generated segment, meaning that each week, the person or organization we feature will be nominated by you. All you have to do is send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org, put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, and tell us about the person or organization that you want to nominate. Now, today's Neighbors in Action segment, since we're new and we didn't have any listeners last week, was nominated by our producer, Joe Lindstroth, and he chose the Allen Neighborhood Center. And with me in the studio to tell us about Allen Neighborhood Center is the director, Joan Nelson. Welcome, Joan.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you on board the very first week. Joe told me about the idea for Neighbors in Action, and I immediately agreed, and I said, we got to start it with Joan.
Oh, well, thanks so much. Appreciate the opportunity.
A lot of people know what the Allen Neighborhood Center is about, but for our listeners who don't, tell us what your mission is.
Well, the Allen Neighborhood Center is a hub for neighborhood revitalization and for activities that support the health, the safety, stability, and economic well-being of people living on Lansing's east side.
Okay.
Essentially, we serve the northeast quadrant of the city, and the 48912 zip code. The east side of Lansing is a pleasure to do this kind of work.
It's a unique neighborhood.
It is a unique neighborhood. It is diverse in every way you can imagine. We have income diversity. We have racial and ethnic diversity. We have actually one of the highest concentration of refugees, of people born in other countries in the region. We have cultural and political diversity. I think, though, that what is most significant about the East Side is that across all of those differences in background and culture and politics and whatnot, people come together around neighborhood improvement. We have over 25 organized neighborhood groups on the East Side, neighborhood watches, neighborhood associations, all volunteer-run entities that are led by people who are the folks who put names to the faces of folks see backing out of driveways to go to work in the morning.
Yeah.
And that the reputation of the East Side for inclusivity, for connectivity, is really in large part due to those all volunteer run neighborhood organizations.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, they're all volunteer run, and so they have limited capacity for carrying out very ambitious projects for neighborhood improvement. And so, about 13, 14 years ago, neighborhood organizations around town, supported by some institutional partners, most notably the health department, decided to try to create a network of neighbor-friendly points of access to a wide range of health and housing and food resources. And what came out of those efforts were a set of neighborhood-based, community-based organizations that include Allen Neighborhood Center, Northwest Initiative, South Lansing Community Development Association, Baker DeNora, South Lansing Community Association. So
okay.
These five are more than simply all volunteer driven neighborhood watches. They are 501c3s. They are nonprofits that are capable of receiving and dispersing funds, hiring staff, carrying out essentially implementation of plans that have been, you know, proposed by organized neighborhood groups for many, many years for neighborhood improvement.
Is there a need that rises to the top, kind of chronically in
you know? Well, the neighborhood centers are able to be pretty creative in how they address chronic social problems, poverty, compromised nutrition, poor health, and so on. All of the neighborhood centers are located, including Allen, are located in low to middle income neighborhoods where there is significant need. So, for instance, in our health program, we sign people up for the Ingham Health Plan, the coverage option for uninsured people in the Lansing area. We link people to medical homes. We have a community health worker that works exclusively with people who suffer from two chronic diseases. We have a pretty lively breast health club comprised of about 1,000 women who get information pretty routinely about how to support health, high levels of health. Our housing-related programs at this point, our housing-related initiative consists of a partnership with the Ingham County Land Bank and Lansing Community College's Construction Technologies Department. And we are working on the renovation of two tax foreclosed homes on Kalamazoo Street. These homes serve as an education and demonstration site for East Side residents interested in in retrofitting, renovating their homes to higher levels of energy efficiency.
And LCC is involved in that.
Very
right?
much,
yeah,
very
that's
much.
That's the LCC piece.
And we're probably best known for our set of pretty synergistic food-related programs that address food security issues. You know, for 11 years, we've had a pantry called Bread Basket, serving about 80 to 100 families each week, each Tuesday. But in 2004, we launched the Allen Street Farmers Market. That market over the last 10 years has become this great sprawling seasonal market, May through October, every Wednesday from 2:30 to 7. And these days, we have about 500 to 1,000 people that stroll through on market day. We have our outreach team is out there. We have featured nonprofits. We have music, a food chatter table, a kids table. And since 2005, we have been plastic friendly. We have a bank in our market that accepts EBT, credit, debit and credit cards, Project Fresh, Senior Project Fresh, and so on. We also, in 2008, launched the Hunter Park Garden House, which has now become a little center for all kinds of gardening education for adults, for children. We have great kids programs at the Garden House, after-school programs for now. We have our own community-supported agriculture project, a CSA, year-round. We have the Urban Gardener Certificate course, which teaches
wow.
neighbors how to grow food in the clay soil and shady lots of the East Side.
And we have a mini university going on
yes.
over there.
Well, and we also are most, we're really excited about the newest project. We're building out a 5,600 square foot warehouse immediately behind the neighborhood center that will house the Allen Street Food Hub, and we'll be opening this year. With an incubator commercial kitchen, lots of food storage options, tons of workshops in that kitchen on culinary, basic culinary skills, safe food handling practices, you know, food preparation and preservation. And we'll be doing aggregation and distribution, linking regional farmers, growers, with food service managers, restaurateurs, caterers in Lansing, so as to increase, you know, purchase and preparation and consumption of okay. locally grown produce.
Tell listeners how they can become involved in the work that you do.
They can check out right. They can check out our website.
Volunteer driven.
Yes, we are utterly volunteer driven. We are a small staff, and the success of our programs depends utterly on volunteers. We have many opportunities. People should log on to our website www.allenneighborhoodcenter.org. Or call 367-2468 to talk to Christina Adair, our volunteer coordinator, about all of the volunteer opportunities in the market, in the hub, in the greenhouse, with our senior program, our kids programs, and more. So
that's fantastic.
Lots of ways to get involved.
That's fantastic. Joe Nelson is director of the Allen Neighborhood Center, which serves Lansing's East Side neighborhood. Thanks again for joining
Thanks
us.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's a pleasure.
Neighbors in Action is the name of our new segment here on WKAR's Current State. This is a Wednesday feature. If you would like to nominate someone or an organization to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment each Wednesday, please send an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Current State takes a quick look at sports. Here we got a Michigan State basketball game here tonight, and WKAR's Earl Robinson stops by to tell us what to expect with Penn State. And from what I understand, Earl, we're going to go from one extreme to the other, because after the Penn State game tonight, we got some pretty stiff competition, and Penn State's a game we should expect to use. What's
yes,
going on there?
Yes, you can't overlook anybody in the Big Ten this year, because the Big Ten is probably the toughest in conference in the nation right now. I mean, they've got at least six very good teams, and then the other ones are okay, but you got six really good teams, and then you have four other teams. So the Big Ten is extremely tough this year. So Michigan State can't take anyone lightly or look over anyone, because they can easily be beat.
And in a couple of sentences, what's the challenge with Ohio State?
Ohio State is a big team, and one of the things that Thad Mata always does, he is a good coach. He doesn't sub much. He plays the same six or seven players every game, and that just makes his team very, very, very strong, and not vulnerable to making a lot of mistakes. So their team is very good, and they just play six or seven players, and they play them the whole game.
How about that? It's going to be intense. Thanks, yes. Earl. Thanks for stopping by.
Okay.
WKAR's Earl Robinson here on the look ahead for Michigan State University basketball. Our executive producer of Current State is a guy who's been with us just since the end of August, Peter Worf, and he's been riding herd on this new program, and it's nice to welcome Peter in this morning.
Thanks, Mark, and congratulations to you and our new producer of the show, Joe Lindstroth, does a lot of the heavy lifting along with you, and in this first week we've already had our governor, our Lansing chief of police, members of the East Lansing School Board, other representatives of the Lansing area community, Ingham County, Ionia, have all been in our studios. You'll hear us more and more take our microphones outside of our studios to discover Mid-Michigan, and that's a big goal of Current State. So next week, of course, we'll be at the auto show, and you'll hear a little something cool every day coming from Cobo Hall, all sorts of developments in the auto industry. Speaking of cars, we have old cars for you, vintage historic cars from the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum, which you're probably familiar with.
Oh, yeah.
Some of our other listeners. So we'll take you from the 1903 curved dash up into the aircraft carrier-sized hoods of the 1970s Oldsmobiles and everything in between. We even have lawnmowers and steam engines. It's all about how technology has influenced the automobile in everyday life. So we'll hear about that. And we'll also, speaking of bridges, take you to the roads. Speaking of cars, we'll take you to the roads and look at some bridges of Ingham County with the founder of the website historicbridges.org. His name is Nathan Holf.
You're going to love this piece, too, by the way.
A very interesting guy with hundreds and hundreds of photos of historic and beautiful bridges from all around Mid-Michigan, North America, and beyond. Nathan Holf will be with us. Well, right now, we're just going to take a few steps across campus to the MSU Museum for an exhibit on the Civil War. We featured a little bit of this yesterday, Mark, with Roger Rosentrader, who takes us around to some more artifacts of the museum, some objects of everyday life in the camps that men experienced, soldiers experienced during the Civil War.
This is a doctor's kit. It's sort of a footlocker-sized box with a very intimidating-looking saw, some probes. Pretty major knives. And what else do we have in here?
Well, there are some probes. I do not have one of these in my collection, even though you can buy a reproduction kit if you really want to. But they do look pretty frightening, actually, when you think about it. And again, the amputations and the infection all being part of the process. There are some pretty frightening pictures after the war. The Surgeon General did a collection of the men who had recovered, survived, and exposing various limbs or what's left of them.
It says here, to treat a bullet wound, a doctor poked a finger into the wound searching for the bullet. If it was possible, he used these forceps here. These are about a foot long to reach in and try and pull it out.
Yeah, and just imagine, again, the... And these hospitals that are set up are sometimes set up literally set up anywhere. You can use a barn. So right away you can imagine the type of germs that are in the barn. Then the doctor is never washing off his hands clearly or any of the tools he's using, and he's taking his finger and probing it into the wound. The odds that anybody survives sometimes are amazing.
We're looking at some of the items here at the exhibit Michigan in the Civil War, the 150th anniversary, with Professor Roger Rosentrader, history professor at Michigan State University. We're talking about fixing men on the battlefield, here's an item here used for fixing clothing and personal possessions.
Yeah, Peter, this is a great item because they're called a housewife, and it's just a sewing kit. And at the outbreak of the war, again, the Army doesn't provide its soldiers like it does today. I mean, yeah, they'll give you a uniform and a gun and a pair of boots or whatever, but beyond that, you really had to provide for yourself. So lots of women on the home front took it upon themselves to create various items for the soldiers, towels, socks, shirts. There was something called a havelock, which if you can imagine was kind of they don't have one on display here, but it was a draping over your kepe, your hat, so that you didn't burn the back of your neck. Soldiers never used them, and that's why you don't see them in the pictures. As a matter of fact, they didn't know what to do with them, and they got them by the literally thousands, and they might use them as a nightcap, or they might clean their weapon with them or whatever. And many of them finally said, don't send us any more of those things because we don't need them. But this housewife, this sewing kit, is an exceptional item on display here. It's identified to a Michigan soldier, and it's even got his name in there. And again, he had to take care of himself. I mean, there isn't anybody on the battlefield, certainly, or anyone going to do his sewing. He's going to have to do his own sewing. He can't go home. He can't go to the tailor, obviously. And if he needs to fix something, here's the item he would use. It is very nice. I've seen several. I own several. This one is as nice as I've seen.
Going to another item of everyday life, this appears to be actual food for soldiers from the Civil War.
Well, it does appear that way. And again, hardtack was the, I don't know if it was popular necessarily is a good way to describe it, but it was available certainly to Northerners, and it was just a cracker made out of flour and water. This particular label says there's lard in it. I've made hardtack for my students, and that's only flour and water and a little bit of salt. I've never put any lard in anything. But these were fairly, yes, you can imagine the name hardtack, so they're hard, right? But they weren't impervious to bugs. And they were called worm castles, as the label explains. And what the soldiers would do is, I mean, again, you couldn't discard them if you were provided with them. You had to make do, and soldiers were always hungry. So one of the ways they would deal with the problem was they'd create their coffee, and again, they didn't go to Beaners or anything like that. You know, if they were lucky, and they were usually Northerners had coffee, they would take their beans, and they'd have some hot water, and they'd put the beans in the bottom of their cup. They've got a cup on display here. Some of the cups were much larger, but they would just kind of break up the beans and pour in the hot water, as it were. Then they would take the hardtack, which is, not impervious to the bugs that are out there, break it up, put the hardtack in the coffee. Now, where are the bugs going to go? Or they're going to seek to flee, they're going to come to the top, and then you use your spoon and you discard the bugs, and then you go on with your meal. So, sounds pretty appetizing, doesn't it?
Roger, what's amazing to me about this hardtack that is on display in the museum, if you can believe it, is it says this is actually still preserved from the Civil War, and it doesn't look too bad.
It doesn't. Matter of fact, I have bought it for my students. There is a Boston bakery that makes hardtack today than they did for the Union Army during the Civil War. And it looks pretty similar, to be honest with you. Well, I'd like to tell you that the Yankees won because of Michigan soldiers, but I guess that's an exaggeration. We sent 90,000 men to the war. That was 50% of our military-aged male population. As a lot of guys, right? And they fought in all the major campaigns and a lot of lesser campaigns as well. Again, there are plenty of stories of where Michigan men performed heroically, men and women, and that's something that I must confess we don't see here, but we should talk about at some point, is that the important role of Michigan women, because it sometimes, as is often the case, we think of war as being a male-oriented or male-only. Yes, the soldiers were largely male, but one of the best known, there were actually several women who served in the ranks from Michigan, on both sides. And some of the better known ones are from Michigan, as it turns out. But, you know, again, Michigan was a solid blue state, I guess I would say, right? It was a solid northern state. Its men went off and fought both in the Eastern Theater and the Western Theater of the war. That served, you know, again, if we talk about generals, we certainly had our share. We had our Medal of Honor winners as well. Maybe we weren't any more unique than certain other states, but we certainly made a major contribution.
That's such a high percentage when you think about the time in history, and then you think about states like New York and Pennsylvania, maybe others like New Jersey, with, I would think, much larger populations.
Yeah. There were larger populations, certainly in those states, as you know. And one of the things that didn't happen here is that almost everybody from Michigan that served in the Union Army was a volunteer. Now, conscription was introduced in the war, and there were a few people from Michigan who were conscripted, but mostly it was volunteers, which, again, conscription was designed to try to encourage volunteering, and it worked. But in Michigan's case, most of these guys signed up, even well into the war, when they knew just how horrendous things were. And there are good stories about, I can think of two brothers, for example, from the Detroit area. Well, the older brother went into the service, and then the younger brother wanted to follow, and the older brother said, "Hey, you don't know what you're missing. You know, just stay out." Well, as it turns out, the younger brother wasn't going to listen to the older brother, joined up, and the two brothers served in different units, and they both died at the Battle of Gettysburg. But again, that whole idea that even later in the war, you've still got plenty of men saying, "It's my duty, my responsibility." And that may seem hokey today, or maybe to some they think, "Oh, that's not." But that really seems to be the attitude. I've got a set of letters from a Michigan woman whose husband went off and served 2 years, and then he was going to stay on. And long story short, he came home after his three-year enlistment, and even late in that particular period of time, and she'd already lost a brother to the war, she said, "You know, we have to make this sacrifice. This union means that much that we all, be it her at home with a young child or her husband in harm's way, we all have to make this sacrifice." So if she's representative, and I'd like to believe she is, these Northerners took it very seriously.
Roger Rosentrater is history professor at Michigan State University. We've been looking at the exhibit, Michigan and the Civil War, the 150th anniversary. Professor Rosentrater, thanks very much.
All right, thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Tomorrow on Current State, Tim Skubick joins me to deconstruct the State of the State speech. And then we're not going to talk about the State of the State speech again for 11 months, we promise. We'll also be joined by Democratic State Senator Gretchen Whitmer of East Lansing during our first half. So it'll be Skubick, Senator Whitmer, and I. What lay deep beneath the ice of Antarctica? You would be surprised. It's being studied here at Michigan State University, and WKAR's Kevin Lavery has the story. And we preview the new season of WKAR-TV's Backstage Pass. The metal band Silent Lapse opens up this year's series. So that's all tomorrow here on Current State. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org. Follow us on Twitter at karcurrentstate.org. Many thanks for your segment ideas as well. We've got some good ones just yesterday. Tom Stewart and his business incubator project. I'm on it. Hashtag Love Lansing on Twitter and how it connects and informs people. Things to do at Hawk Island Park, winter and summer. The history of the fish ladder in downtown, the Brenke fish ladder. And do fish really use the fish ladder? That is a question that deserves an answer. We appreciate your emails and your story suggestions and your feedback. currentstate@wkar.org, Twitter @KAR Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day.